This is Artistic Director Martha Levy, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Audio Program. Steppenwolf Theatre Company presents Endgame by Samuel Beckett, directed by ensemble member Frank Galati, featuring Jan Barford, Francis Guinan, Martha Levy, and William Peterson. As we began reading plays for our 2009-2010 season exploring the idea of belief, several of the ensemble members participating in the process felt it was important to consider plays that spoke not just to faith and belief, but that challenged belief. Plays that envisioned a world where the extant systems of belief had collapsed. We were particularly alert to those early and mid-20th century plays that surveyed a world relativized by the science of evolution, by the psychological explorations of Sigmund Freud, by the horrors of World War. At the dawn of the 20th century, the touchstones of religious belief felt less secure, and alternative narratives were being proffered across the arts and sciences. Samuel Beckett's work, emerging mid-century, has gained signature status as the record of this collective anxiety. Beckett's most famous play, Waiting for Godot, is commonly regarded as the emblematic expression of this godless world, an existential landscape in which the play's heroes are figured as vaudevillian clowns, futilely anticipating their salvation. Endgame succeeds Godot and Beckett's canon. It is, in the estimation of some, the greater play. Endgame is, in any case, a distillation of thought, a pressurized expression of the world of Godot. What happens in the play? Not much, and everything. Where in Godot the setting of the play is a landscape, a plane on which strangers meet, Endgame is a bare interior, a closed environment in which our characters, long known to each other, negotiate their relationships. The first word of the play, finished. The play essays Beckett's presiding theme, our confrontation with our mortality. From the opening moment of the play, Beckett is announcing that the game is over, over before it has begun. It is a world of limitations, a bare interior, and four characters. Our protagonist, Ham, is blind and cannot walk. His companion, Clove, cannot sit down. Their partnership, variously figured in the play as a servitude, a father-son relationship, a strange marriage, is, in any case, a symbiosis, a closed loop. Our two other characters, whom we learn are Ham's parents, Nag and Nell, spend the play in ash bins. Their appearance is summoned by Ham's commands, which Clove executes. We are, in some sense, inside Ham's head, watching him play out his endgame. What is startling about this claustrophobic world in Beckett's rendering is the eruption of the comic. Ham's first lines, me, to play, is a wonderfully layered expression of Beckett's canny conflation of form and substance. We are watching a play about play. The central character's name, Ham, alerts us to the fact that our guide into this world is an unreliable narrator of his own experience. A ham, of course, is a label for an actor given to overstatement, unsubtle in his craft. Watching a play within a play, this layering of acting and watching, invites a question. Who is watching us? Who is it that is seeing our lives as a play? The play in which we are acting, our lives, will end in our own deaths. That is our tragedy. In Endgame, Beckett suggests that what we as Ham feel as tragic is also, always, comic, absurd play. We are always someone's entertainment. Our urgencies are always within the context of an endgame. All human lives end the same way. We die. But we resist that surety. We play it out. Ham's first audience, his companion, his servant, Clove, dutifully plays his part in the game. The two other characters in the play, Nag and Nell, are Ham's parents. It's here that Ham's blindness is germane, summoning, as it does, that great tragic character, Oedipus. If Ham is in a play, Beckett suggests by alluding to Oedipus, then it is a tragedy of his own making. Ham struggles mightily, comically, in the kingdom of his own mind, blind to his own actions, but dedicated to constructing a narrative to make sense of life. Late in the play, Ham says to himself, alone on the stage, "Use your head, can't you? Use your head. You're on Earth. There's no cure for that. The end is in the beginning, and yet you go on. Perhaps I could go on with my story, end it, and begin another. It will be the end, and there I'll be, wondering what could have brought it on, and wondering what can have, why it was so long in coming." The story that Ham tells Clove earlier in the play becomes a meaningful inscription of his own condition. "I once knew a madman who thought the end of the world had come. He was a painter, an engraver. I had a great fondness for him. I used to go and see him in the asylum. I'd take him by the hand and drag him to the window. Look, there, all that rising corn, and look, there, the sails of the herring fleet, all that loveliness. He'd snatch away his hand and go back into his corner, appalled. All he had seen was ashes. He alone had been spared. Forgotten. It appears the case was not so unusual." The great motif of the play is this layering of stories. Stories narrated, stories acted out. Ham can relate the story of this madman who misrecognizes the world and by increments has come to understand that the case was not so unusual. The construction of the play as a series of stories and plays within their own stories and plays is Beckett's genius. He uses the vocabulary of the theater to suggest our human condition. We are always an actor in, a teller of our own story, only partially able to see the whole picture. The marvel of Beckett's work is that the profundity of his thought is matched by such a ridiculous sense of play. Scholars have written volumes about his plays. Great theater artists have dedicated their lives to playing his texts. But the plays invite, as well, a naive approach. I love that one of the most famous productions of Waiting for Godot was performed by prisoners at San Quentin, men who came to the work understanding quite simply the reality of confinement, of a world without escape. The large existential vision that Beckett was offering in his play was viscerally available to them, as, one imagines, was the humor so intimately connected to that vision. Come first to Beckett's play with the confidence that everything in the play is available to you. We know ourselves as storytellers, as a species given to play, as both actor and audience to our own lives. Endgame is a beautifully expressive vision of our endgame, a funny and sad and ultimately sympathetic view of our struggle with our own mortality.
The Game at Hand, artistic director Martha Levy talks with director Frank Galati. I'm Suzanne Miller as Martha Levy.
And I'm Tim McCarthy as Frank Galati.
Frank, you've been reading and teaching and studying and acting in Beckett for a long time.
In fact, when I was a freshman at Western Illinois University in 61 or 62, the first university theater production I was in was Waiting for Godot. I played Vladimir. So my relationship with this world and this writer go back to the beginning of my own experiences in the theater as an actor and as a director.
Did it ring your bell right away?
It did. I never questioned or had any trouble with the material. I don't remember any high-minded conversations in that early encounter with Waiting for Godot about how absurd this is or how unrealistic or how abstract. Lots of the complaints about Beckett I don't recall ever having registered. I always received the world and believed it. It was always complete and whole as work of art, accomplishing what it sets out to accomplish. I think the experience of being in the play as such a young guy was formative for me. Its rhythms, the mystery of its exchanges, the dialogue, the routines. Those aspects of Waiting for Godot became distilled and tightened in Endgame.
If your first production of Beckett was in 61, that's much nearer to the play's birth. The first production of Endgame was at the Royal Court in 1957. What was the cultural moment happening in the world that was relevant to Beckett? Why were these plays an expression of it?
Even though my experience with the play was 15 to 20 years after the end of World War II, I, as a beginning college student, could still feel the afterburn, the heat of the war. When I saw in high school the images of the Holocaust, they were almost freshly released, or that's the way it felt. My Uncle Charlie was in the invasion of D-Day and in Europe at the climax of World War II. I had a sense that the zeitgeist was still full of the dust and debris, of carnage of World War II and even World War I. It is very hard to explain the shadow that still hung over the world, even on the threshold of the 60s. The turbulence, the madness, the chaos, the pain, the anguish, the palpable evil unleashed in the world is part of what made the birth of theater of the absurd feel strangely right.
And how would you define theater of the absurd?
Martin Esslin coined the phrase, and I'm not sure that Beckett hasn't transcended it. I think the sense of the absurd, of the world broken apart, dismantled of the rational thought, charged through the first half of the 20th century. In my own adventure of years of teaching in the 20th century and putting Beckett in context, I would always go back with my students to the turn of the century, the almost cataclysmic shift in, let's just say, the musical language of Western culture, where, for example, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring in 1913 experimented with tonalities that were so off the charts of understood harmony that audiences went mad. There were riots in the theater, people screaming and beating each other, advocates and dissidents. It all had something to do with the impact of Freud and the first popular understanding of the ideas of the unconscious and the subconscious.
Wikipedia's definition is interesting because it says, in chess, the endgame refers to the stage of the game where there are a few pieces left on the board. Endgames often revolve around attempts to promote a pawn by advancing it to a unique rank. The king, which has to be protected in the middle game owing to the threat of checkmate, becomes a strong piece in the endgame and can be brought to the center of the board and be useful for attacking.
Beckett has said that nothing is more frustrating than observing a game of chess being played by two incompetents who really don't know how to play the game. Beckett accuses Ham of being a bad player in his biography, and I wonder if that is somehow related to the comic vein in the play. There is a tremendous flip of opposites at work in the disabled king. The king who rules with magnificence and pomposity, and who is just completely without subjects.
It is interesting that you say Beckett called them bad players, because they are also the king and pawn on the chessboard.
Yes. I just flashed on Caliban's from The Tempest, vicious attack on Prospero when he says, "I am all the subjects that you have. You have no subject except me." Ham's loftiness is part of the comedy, in my opinion. One of his first utterances in the play is, "Can there be misery loftier than mine?"
Toward the end of the play, we feel the end game. Will the pawn take the king?
Yes. Just as I said in that first speech, Ham asked, "Who has suffered more than me? My mother? My father?" But then, instead of saying brother or lover, he says dog. And the resonance of the word in terms of clav is obvious. Master slash slave, hammer slash nail. What Beckett likes is that the hammer and nail is the equation of Ham's relationship with all three of the other characters. Because Nell is nail, Nag is nail, and clav is nail in the polylingual world that Beckett lived in. He was fluent in 10 or 11 languages.
The characters merge the act of the theater with storytelling, but is anybody watching them?
This is a very, very important and probing question in terms of Beckett's aesthetic. It is something he rehearses in lots of different ways, and he vacillates back and forth from play to play. One of the most dazzling self-referential moments in Endgame happens when Clav, who is trying to create a little order, picks up the telescope. He turns it on the auditorium and he says, "I see a multitude in transports of joy." That's what I call a magnifier. Now, an interesting feature of this exploration of Beckett's aesthetic is that he was nervous about these self-referential moments. And in the production notebooks, he cuts out every reference to the audience.
Really? And that's the version that we're using in performance.
That's correct. So that little exchange that I just paraphrased, "I see a multitude in transports of joy," he elides from the script.
This idea of being watched is fundamental to the theatrical transaction as you are describing it, the fiction that the people on stage maintain of not being watched. Where is the God Beckett is imagining? Isn't there a psychological, some would say spiritual, necessity of a God that is a watcher?
Absolutely. In fact, this chain of being that we are referring to finally ends with the deity and the hope of the deity. Let us pray to God, Ham says, and then at the end of the sequence, after they're all fervently praying, Ham says, "Bastard, he doesn't exist." But the hope, the aspiration, the need to be watched by God, and the aftermath of something as horrible as the earthquake in Haiti, you have to think, is God watching? Or maybe he really is watching, or she is watching, and maybe the explosion of the earth is God's rage at the world for not paying attention to the poverty and the misery of the people of Haiti.
What are any sort of final things that you want to say about this play to an audience? How should they listen and watch it?
With open arms, not afraid of the dark, as Beckett says, and he believes is the most important line in the play Endgame, when Nell says, "Nothing is funnier than unhappiness." To receive the comedy of the isolated souls, where we are in our own privacy, in our own sorrow, and where in spite of that darkness and in spite of that pain, a laugh bubbles up. I think a great work of art asks us to step up into it and accept its wisdom, its vision of truth. It is obtained in the way we are disarmed by laughter. And when we are disarmed by laughter, that disability that discombobulates us allows the piercing truth to teach as well as to please.
I think that is beautiful, Frank. And I think it's also important to be open to feeling that kind of solitude, that darkness, to go into the theater and be comfortable that you know enough, that if you let this play's language and characters live, then you will actually understand.
Oh, completely. There is nothing out of reach in this play. It is so personal. That is one of the things about Beckett's work that is so enduring. It doesn't unpack a battlefield of history. It doesn't reflect political combat or fashion. It is not rhetorical. It doesn't argue for anything. It isn't conservative or liberal. It doesn't deposit or take any kind of point of view in our terms of issues. It's about us. It's about our own lives, and no human being who really lives in the world is without self-examination. Going to the theater is one opportunity we have to really think about ourselves. Not about the other that is up there on the stage, but about ourselves, and it's not so hard to do. We are all facing the final catastrophe, however you want to put it, whether it is liberation into some paradisiacal ether, or whether the lid closes. We're all facing it, and we can face it with good humor and vitality, and we can go on. That is what Beckett trumpets, going on.
Samuel Beckett, From Start to Endgame, by artistic apprentice Rebecca Stevens. Midway through Samuel Beckett's Endgame, Ham laments, "Nature has forgotten us." His servant Clove corrects him, "There is no more nature." These men, seen only in the small room that shields them from the outside, live in a world where nothing stirs or breathes. Clove repeatedly searches the horizon with a telescope, only to report, "Zero, zero, zero." Beckett crafts this landscape through subtraction of place, of objects, and even of language, until the world of the play is bare. Audiences and academics alike have sought to interpret this inhospitable and hopeless terrain, declaring it a post-atomic wasteland or a manifestation of nihilism. However one chooses to decipher the sparse world in which these characters bicker and survive, the task of interpretation is a daunting one. How does one find meaning in a world characterized by nothingness? Beckett would disagree that searching for meaning is a necessary task for his plays. When asked, he once snapped, "It means what it says." Nonetheless, examining his life in the years leading up to Endgame allows one to glimpse how his experiences and influences may have shaped the landscape he created. Without World War II, the world might never have had the plays and novels of Samuel Beckett. His most famous works, Endgame and Waiting for Godot, were first produced in 1957 and 1953, respectively, a decade after the fighting ended. Before the war, he lived in Paris, assisting fellow Irishman James Joyce on Finnegan's Wake and dabbling in writing. As his biographer Deirdre Baer notes, "It is interesting to speculate what sort of writer Beckett might have become if it hadn't been for the war, from his correspondence and conversation, it seems likely that he would have concentrated on criticism and reviewing as the most immediately remunerative, and might have turned to poetry and fiction in his spare time. But the war began, and as it approached Beckett's doorstep in Paris, he chose to stay in France, first out of skepticism about the coming conflict, and eventually because he could not leave. He finally fled Paris when the Nazis arrived, fearing the consequences of not having his citizenship and immigration papers in order. For nearly a month, he wandered by train and foot, avoiding checkpoints, sleeping on dirt floors, and scavenging for food. He eventually returned to Paris, and he joined the fledgling and highly disorganized French resistance. He translated intelligence, embedded microfilm with messages, and allowed his apartment to serve as a drop-off location. After several terrifying brushes with discovery, betrayal arrived at his doorstep, and he fled with his companion, Suzanne de Chevelle du Mesnil, mere hours ahead of the Germans. From these incidents, one can grasp what Beckett might have meant when Ham tells Clove not to leave the shelter of the room, warning, "Outside of here, it's death," and how a world turned upside down, scant for resources, and filled with fear and uncertainty, feels and looks. Beckett escaped to Roussillon, a farm community in the mountainous regions of southeast France, relatively free of German occupation. There he waited for the war to end. At first, the countryside was a welcome haven after the terror of Paris, but eventually the open countryside became an unbearable prison for Beckett. He suffered deteriorating health, and psychosomatic illnesses manifested in coughs, boils, and hallucinations brought on by sleeplessness. Beckett's physical ailments are interesting when compared with those of his characters. Clove, the servant in Endgame, moves with a stiff, staggering walk and cannot sit. Beckett reportedly had foot problems that led to a lurching gait and a history of cysts in his anus. While Beckett's characters did not always mirror his own health troubles so closely, a preoccupation with the body's decay populates his work. This deep interest reflected not only his reoccurring struggles, psychosomatic illness, but also his intimate experience with the chronic sickness of others. He worked in the Irish Red Cross directly after the war and served as his dying brother's nursemaid when his sister-in-law could not bear the task. When Beckett finally returned, he discovered post-war Paris was not the city it once was. Its nightlife and economy remained in shambles, and its citizens were horrified and disoriented by the past 6 years of unthinkable war. Though the correlation between wartime Europe and the bleak plays he wrote in its aftermath seems obvious, Beckett resisted such simple parallels. Beckett lived through the terror of being an alien in an occupied country, struggled against a dictator of unthinkable evil, and survived self-imposed imprisonment in a sparse countryside. Yet, throughout this time, he repeatedly risked his life by joining a resistance movement to help others. "I was fighting against the Germans, who were making life hell for my friends," he explained on more than one occasion. The gulf between his experiences and his attitude reflect the duality so often found in his work, and in Endgame in particular. The intrinsic belief that there is humanity worth fighting for, grinding against a world so bleak that Clove believes it must be nearly finished. Though the events of the war had an undeniable impact on him, he never acknowledged it. He was puzzled and frustrated by the wide disinterest in his novels and the frequent criticism that he should stop trying to disguise his wartime memoirs within the framework of fiction and write a realistic account instead. He did not believe he was creating a landscape that deliberately characterized the world during or after the war. Unable to sustain a career as a novelist, Beckett slipped into the debilitating depression and heavy drinking that had characterized periods of his life before the war. Hoping to pull himself away from what he felt was a creative impasse, he began writing plays. "I turned to writing plays to relieve myself of the awful depression the prose led me into," he explained. "Life at that time is too demanding, too terrible, and I thought theater would be a diversion." As a self-identified novelist, Beckett found playwriting a delightful exercise, a game of pitting players and their actions against each other. He likened this deliberate plotting to chess, a favorite pastime whose scholars, in particular the artist and champion chess player Michael Duchamp, he deeply admired. Its importance is echoed in the title Endgame, the third and final stage of the game, in which players make their last moves toward an inevitable conclusion. In playwriting, Beckett found an audience engaged in his work that he never found in his novels. Part of Beckett's significance as a playwright lies in the landscape he created, in his pioneering of a form that had not yet emerged when he first began writing. He wrote recognizable colloquial dialogue and situations that were impossibly stripped of context. The landscape of Beckett's work and the characters he depicts within them don't require an understanding of his personal attitudes and circumstances in order to engage them. Beckett strongly believed that Ham and Clove were not representative of a universal situation, but were two personalities operating within the framework of a specific localized incident. He did not seek to create characters who broadly represented any part of the history he had lived through or his own personal conflicts. They are distinct to the environment and relationships Beckett created. By understanding Beckett's history, one has a greater sense of why he sought to portray such a barren landscape. And in delving into the reasons why, the story of the four people surviving in it becomes deeply moving. Mad Men advertised Beckett, overthinking the play by Director of Artistic Development Polly Carl. Theater is a series of ongoing interpretations. The playwright, director, dramaturg, designers, and actors come together in a collaborative process, seeking a multitude of possibilities for the presentation of a play. At some point, in order to bring in the audience, the play freezes. The script is finalized, the set is built, the sound and lights are programmed, and the actors find their rhythm. But the possible meanings of the play go on in post-show discussions, drinks after the play, and late-night pillow talk. My hope is to provide some heat to your conversations when you leave the theater, to thaw what we've temporarily frozen and invite you to collaborate in making meaning in theater with us. In the dead zone between the NFL playoffs and college basketball's March Madness, I try to catch up on all of the popular culture I've missed or overlooked. So recently, I watched 3 seasons of the AMC television series Mad Men in just over 2 weeks. Mad Men begins in 1960, just 3 years after the premiere of Beckett's Endgame. One of the best parts of Mad Men is how it reminds us of some of the very first television ad campaigns, airlines, underwear, and the Kodak carousel slide projector. The confluence of television and the rise of the ad offices on Madison Avenue is a powerful reminder of a point of origin where we see projected multiple incentives to materialism. The ad campaigns capture the momentum of a new technological age and the sense that time is moving faster and life is getting more exciting, an excitement we can buy. Post-World War II philosophy, however, is filled with a sense of the meaninglessness of the capitalist engine. In the face of the reality of the atomic bomb and possibility of the end of time, meaning is elusive. In Mad Men, with its alluring portrayal of smoking and drinking and buying, we are presented with an alternative to the rising nihilistic impulse of the era. Or are we? I argue that in some strange way, Endgame and the Mad Men of Madison Avenue, as depicted in 2010, are the flip side of the same coin. The nothingness in Endgame is juxtaposed with the excesses of Mad Men, and in both cases, the notion that meaning exists is up for grabs. One of my favorite philosophers, Theodore Adorno, says of Endgame, "Beckett, as educated as anyone presents the bill, philosophy or spirit itself, proclaims its bankruptcy as the dreamlike dross of the experiential world, and the poetic process shows itself as worn out." For Adorno, that poetic process is what drama depends upon, the ability to create a beginning, a middle, and an end, and to create characters who go on journeys and find meaning along the way. Endgame, according to Adorno, recognizes that after the Second World War, everything is destroyed, even resurrected culture without knowing it. Humanity vegetates along, crawling, after events that even the survivors cannot survive, on a pile of ruins which renders futile self-reflection of one's own battered state. In Endgame, Ham demands that Clove wheel him around the room and back to the center, and then keeps insisting, "I feel a little far to the left, I feel a little far to the right." We recognize that his journey back to the center of this cramped, dilapidated space is no journey at all. Ham never goes anywhere in the play, physically or metaphorically. As Adorno says, "This is a place where self-reflection is impossible. To look back, we would have to be able to look ahead." When Mad Men creative director Don Draper pitches the ad campaign for the Kodak slide projector, we travel through Don's life. He shows intimate pictures of his family to the account executives as he deters the men at Kodak from their notion that using the word wheel is the way to sell this thing. Rather, as we see the pictures of Don and his wife Betty spread out on a picnic blanket sharing a hot dog, a photo of his two children in a little red wagon, and Don kissing the stomach of his pregnant wife, Don tells us that technology is a glittering lure, but that he wants to take the product further to build a deeper bond with the project, nostalgia. It's not called a wheel, he says. It's called the carousel. It lets us travel the way a child travels, round and round and back home again, to a place we know we are loved. But like Ham, Don has no access to self-reflection on his carousel. His numerous affairs with women will make it impossible for him to go home again. His conspicuous consumption proclaims its bankruptcy like the dreamlike dross. His actions leave his wife Betty alienated and alone. Just moments before we ride Don's carousel, we see Betty, on her psychiatrist's couch, proclaiming, "Don has no idea what family is." His successful ad campaigns may move him a little left and a little right, but ultimately, his carousel of family will go nowhere. We see in this amazing scene a different kind of wasteland that exposes what appear as moments of abundance to be void of the intended meaning. Mad Men lays bare the facade of the idea that time moves us forward. Adorno says, like time, the temporal itself is damaged. And as Ham observes, and the horizon? Nothing on the horizon?